Okay, so let's get started. We are going to do a test video capture today. There's a camera that's shown up on the ceiling. It will take us a little bit of time to get it all working. Okay. Anyway, so just to continue where we left off last time, we were talking about virtualization of various forms, and this is a quick recap of the various forms of virtualization. So we have full emulation, where you emulate a PC in software. I gave examples of this box and virtual PC and so on. I actually have a virtual PC on my machine, so I can show how this works actually. So this is virtual PC. We have two virtual machines here. You see a Minix machine. This is a toy version of Unix called Minix, and there's Windows XP. Just to show you, I'm just going to start this Minix. So it just started up. So what happens is it stores the state of the entire VM on disk. So when you start up, it brings it up. Now this is, if you look at it, it's x86 machine that is running on a PowerPC. This is an old Mac, which is still a PowerPC architecture. So virtual PC is doing full emulation. Every assembly instruction that you run here, I mean any program, just runs as is. So when you do this, it's going to run every instruction, do a dynamic translation, and execute it on the PowerPC. Right? So that's basically, it's a little slow because you're doing emulation of IX86 architecture on PowerPC. So everything has to be emulated, but nevertheless it works. Okay, it works. So this, and you can start XP, it's going to do the same thing. So as far as operating systems are concerned, they just see a modified X86 PC. Okay, just to give you an example of okay, so that's virtual PC. So the other technique we are talking about is native virtualization, where the VM emulates or simulates enough hardware to run unmodified operating systems. Para virtualization, where you do the same thing but you make some modifications to the OS itself. And we'll talk more about that today. OS level virtualization and application level virtualization. So this is JVM. Here the OS is providing you coarse containers. It's not full virtualization, but you just get the illusion of having your own machine. Okay. So those were the types of virtualization. We talked about this type 1 hypervisor, which is where the hypervisor runs on bare hardware, the guest OS runs on top of the hypervisor, and applications run inside the guest OS. So each VM, so there can be multiple VMs here, each VM assumes that it's the only one running. Whenever it executes a sensitive instruction, they're trapped to the hypervisor and the hypervisor executes them. So hypervisor is like the kernel here. Okay. Type 2 hypervisor is basically one where you are probably more familiar with this. So what I just showed you is a type 2 hypervisor. You have a host operating system. There's a virtual machine, or the hypervisor runs on top of the host. The guest runs inside the VM. Okay. So that's called a type 2 hypervisor. And what happens here is the virtual machine loads all of the programs and creates a cache, and it scans all the instructions. If it finds a sensitive instruction, it replaces it with a custom call. Okay, so because a sensitive instruction that runs in user space is just going to be ignored, as we talked about last time on x86 architecture. So these are replaced by custom procedures. So whenever you hit it, you will call, make a function call, you will emulate that the effect of that instruction in the VM, and then go from there. Yes, question there.
Is there any particular reason why type 1 hypervisor does not use binary computation?
Is there any particular reason why a type 1 hypervisor does not use binary? So in this case, what is happening is, so you are not under the full control of the guest, right? So the guest is just running by itself. Okay, it's going to execute privilege instructions, and you go here. the equivalent of that is para virtualization, which I'll talk about. It doesn't do binary translation, but it does something similar. Okay, so let's just finish that, then maybe we can answer that question. You'll probably get a better idea of how this works. Okay, so in any case, so you scan and look for sensitive instructions, replace them with a custom call. So then when the OS executes it, or any privileged process executes it, you will actually make a call into the hypervisor. The hypervisor executes that privileged operation and you move. Okay. Now this also allows the hypervisor to work without any hardware support. Okay, type 1 hypervisors require hardware support, as we had mentioned. Okay, so now, coming back to the question of why could you not go and do this. So there is a third strategy called para virtualization, which allows the hypervisor to run on hardware on older hardware without any VT support, for example. Okay, so what happens here is that you go and actually modify the operating system itself, okay, and you replace every sensitive instruction with a custom call. This is what type 2 hypervisors did on the fly. Okay, they actually scanned the code as it was executing, looked for these instructions and replaced them with custom call. Here you do it offline at design time by actually replacing in the code of the kernel, for example, these calls. Okay, these calls we'll refer to them as hyper calls, okay, similar to system calls. So you have your type 1 hypervisor. This is a modified Linux that you have created, where you have replaced every sensitive instruction with a function call. And this is done, as I said, in this case, it's done offline. Can you execute it? And whenever, now in this case, Linux is no longer under the illusion that it is running on bare hardware, okay, because it is not going to execute any instructions. Instead, whenever it wants to do anything privileged, it just makes a hyper call to the kernel. Just as applications make system calls to the kernel whenever they want to do anything privileged, the same thing happens here. Okay, modified Linux in this case is going to do that. So that's a third strategy, and that is what has been used. Okay, there is no conceptual reason why you don't want to do this binary translation, but para virtualization has better performance because you're not doing binary translation on the fly. You do it once and for all, and it's heavily optimized, so you get better performance. So this is the approach that has actually become more popular. There's a question here. No. Okay. Is this clear what para virtualization is? Any questions? So that's that's basically type 1 para virtualization. So here you see another you have two of these, right? So this is para virtualized and this is not. If you don't do para virtualization, you are back to the same thing. Whenever you have sensitive instructions, you have to trap. On the other hand, here you make a function call. Okay, so you can support both in type 1. In type 2, you only have to do binary translation. Okay. Now, as you can probably imagine, if you want to do para virtualization, you have to go and modify the operating system. Okay, because you are replacing sensitive instructions with hypercall. Now, this can get clunky if you have lots of different para virtualized hypervisors. Okay, so here we have one. So you modify Linux to make it work on this hypervisor. Now someone else may write another hypervisor with a different API. Then you have to create another version of Linux or whatever operating system you want for that hypervisor. And when you run on bare hardware, none of this is true. You are executing sensitive instructions. So this will quickly create a problem where you have to create custom versions of the kernel depending on whether you are running on the hardware, the physical hardware, or in different hypervisors. Okay, and to prevent this problem, what many VM designers have done is that they have written an interface called the virtual machine interface. Okay. Now, so you basically create one version of the kernel. Okay, and then rather than directly executing sensitive instructions or various types of hypercalls, you use a generic interface called VMIL. Okay, so this is virtual interface library, and you just program to that. Okay. So all sensitive operations program to this library, and then this library decides at runtime whether it's running on bare hardware, in which case those calls directly translate to assembly instruction, or if it is running on hypervisor from VMware or Xen, it will then make appropriate hyper calls. Okay. So this is basically separating the functionality of making privileged operations from the specific APIs that you have to use. In case of the hardware, the APIs will directly make this call the sensitive instruction, execute that. In case of hypervisor, let's say from VMware, they have their own API and Xen has its own API. So this basically allows you to separate this, so you don't have to create many versions of the kernel. Instead, all of that is just hidden in this layer, okay, and it is going to do that translation for you. Any questions here? So, yes. Right. So, is it possible to run a hypervisor within a hypervisor? Now, certainly, if you go here, right, so within this Linux, you can certainly run another type 2 hypervisor. You can't run a type 1 hypervisor on a type 1. That doesn't make any sense because, by definition, type 1 hypervisor runs on hardware. So, the question that you ask is, can you run a type 2 hypervisor in an OS that's running on a type 1 hypervisor? That's possible because this could be any arbitrary application. Okay, as far as this kernel is concerned, it doesn't know that it's application A versus, let's say, type 2 hypervisor. It just works as is, okay, because it's going to do the same thing. Any other questions there? Now, the only thing you have to do if you do implement a type 2 hypervisor is that when it makes the appropriate calls, you may have to do something else. You may not be able to run it unmodified, but conceptually should be possible. Any other questions here? Okay, so that's virtual machine interface. And now we are going to talk about two other resources, virtualizing the memory and virtualizing the hardware. Okay, all of the discussion so far was virtualizing the CPU. Okay, what are the sensitive instructions? How do you execute them within different context or different hypervisor? But there are other resources. You have to do something for the memory accesses as well as something for I/O accesses. Okay. Now, as far as memory virtualization is concerned, what you have to do is figure out how to do the page table mapping. That's really what it comes down to. Okay? Any operating system kernel creates page tables for every process that is executing, and it maintains these mappings. Okay? The page table basically says for every page within the address space, where is it present in physical memory. Okay? So if you access virtual address I, you have to translate it to a page number within that virtual address and then look up the page table to say where it is stored on physical in physical RAM. Okay, that's what demand paging and so on allows you to do. You can create these flexible mappings. Now, because you are running in an hypervisor, not on physical hardware, there may be multiple VMs running, and within each VM there's an operating system. Okay, and within each operating system are many page tables. So somehow the hypervisor has to deal with all of this. Okay, and remember that each OS thinks that it's the only kernel running on physical hardware. It doesn't know about the presence of other operating systems. Okay, so you have your hypervisor. Let's say just take one VM. Okay, here you have the applications. Okay, and these are the page tables. Basically, whenever the application accesses some address in memory, we look up a page table to look up its physical location and then go and access it. Okay. Now, changing page tables, etc., is a sensitive operation because the applications from user space are not allowed to change. Only the kernel is allowed to change. Now, in this case, the kernel is running in user space, so it cannot actually go and create a new page table, for instance, whenever a new process starts, because it is not running in privileged mode. Is the hypervisor that's running in privileged mode. Okay? So you have to do something equivalent. So that's equivalent of sensitive instructions. All of the things we talked about previously apply here. Okay? Meaning you either take a trap into the hypervisor if you have VT support and have the hypervisor create the page table for you. If this is para-virtualized, creating a new page table basically results in a hyper call. So the hypervisor saying create a new page table for me, the hypervisor is going to do it for you. Okay? So creating and deallocating page tables is easy. They are privileged operations, so all of the techniques we talked about on the previous slides apply here directly. Okay? Now modifying page tables on the other hand is problematic. That is not a privileged operation. Okay? Modifying page table just says page table is a data structure in memory. Okay, modifying a page table is just going and changing some bits in a field in the page table. Only the kernel can do that because the page table resides in kernel address space. But it's not a privileged operation. It's just a load or store into a memory location. Okay, that's not privileged. So that is much harder for the hypervisor to figure out when the kernel goes and changes this page table, because it has to create a second mapping to actually keep track of where the page is. Okay? Because as far as this OS is concerned, it thinks it's the only thing running on the hardware, so it thinks it's managing all of the memory from location 0 through n, where n is the size of the RAM that has been given to it. Okay? Now there are multiple of these running, so there's another OS running on this hypervisor, say OS2, and there are new sets of apps, and this OS also thinks it's managing memory from 0 to n prime, where n prime is the amount of RAM given to it. Okay? But the actual memory is now mapped by the hypervisor into the physical RAM, because not both of them cannot go from 0 to n. Okay? So you will take your RAM and you will partition it, and you will allocate one chunk to this operating system and another chunk to here. So what the hypervisor does is it keeps something called shadow page table, which is a second level page table. So whenever this OS wants to access location I, you then go and look up the real page table, that's the shadow page table maintained by the hypervisor for this kernel, and I do that lookup. And that's the real location of that page. Okay, now this is hidden from the kernel, because the kernel doesn't need to know. All it is doing is it's accessing its page tables, and somebody else is going to do the translation for you. Okay? Now the question is, whenever this page, so this is a page table that's shadowing this page table. This keeps the real entries, and this keeps logical entries. Okay, these are now become logical pages, and these become pointers to physical pages. Okay, so there's a two-level mapping, where the application is looking, causing the OS to look in this page table. This lookup is actually going to be translated using that page table. Okay.
Keeping the page tables should be put into the layer of hypervisor.
Yes, page tables are kept here because the hypervisor does whatever a real kernel on bare metal hardware does, right? In a real kernel, the operating system, in this case, if this was actually running on physical hardware, this is the page table. Okay, now whatever is here has migrated here, because this is the one entity that really knows the location. It's all doing the memory management for you. Okay, so there has to be this two-level mapping, because this is an unmodified kernel, so you can't change anything to have this directly point here. So whenever it looks up this, you have to do the translation by looking this up. Okay? So the point I was trying to make is, if this page table changes because you swapped out some pages and the OS went and changed some entries here, you have to reflect that in the physical page table. Okay, but this is, as I said, is not a privileged operation. So how do you do this? So one thing you could do is you could mark this page table as read-only. Okay, the hypervisor can go and change the pages where this page table is stored and mark it read-only. So if the kernel actually tries to modify that page table, it's going to cause a trap. Okay, because it's modified, it's a read-only page, you try to write to it, this is going to cause a trap, and the trap will then go to the hypervisor, because this is running in ring 0. So now the hypervisor knows that the OS tried to do something. It's going to infer what was it trying to do, what instruction was it trying to execute, and re-execute it in privileged mode. Okay, and actually change the page table on behalf of the OS. Okay? Now this is basically a hack. Okay, this is not the way it should have worked, but that's the way things work. Okay, that's the way the hypervisors are implemented. Yes, question. Yes. Yes. So in this case, the question is, only way you know this is because the hypervisor keeps track of it. You have to do that because there is no other way around it. You have to keep track. For every page table here, there is a shadow page table here, which is the real page table. This is just a fake page table to prevent the OS from being modified. Okay. So every time you touch this, you really have to go and do something here. So you can mark it read only or some such thing. So you take a trap and you go in there and do the actual translation. Okay, there was another question, yes.
Can you explain the step of context switch between two complete features?
How to do context switch between two virtual machines?
No, two applications.
Two applications within a virtual machine?
Yeah.
Okay, so everything above this works exactly the way it used to work before. So if there is application A and application B, let's say application A was executing, its quantum expires, okay? So it basically relinquishes the CPU. You load this application, By load, you mean you load the state of it, which is you are going to load the page tables into the page table registers and so on. Okay, and then that's it. And then this application begins to run. There's no difference. What's the confusion?
Let's just of the global page table, you change your register to.
Yes, you do need to change the register, and the hypervisor can track that. Now there is another level of scheduling happening, which is the hypervisor decides which VM to run. Okay, this is the real CPU. The first level of scheduling is hypervisor says let's run VM1, because these are now, as far as the hypervisor is concerned, these are applications. Okay, so the hypervisor says let's run this, so this VM begins to run, and then the kernel scheduler here says let's run this application, and that application begins to run. So it's multi-level scheduling that's going on. You have a question there? Yes. For every memory instruction, is there a two-level lookup happening? You don't have to do that, because what you can actually do is just remap this page to this page. So when it looks this up, it's actually looking that up automatically for you. You see what I'm saying?
Who does this remapping?
The hypervisor has to do page remapping. So in other words, this memory location and this memory location can be made identical. So when you look this up, you are actually looking up this data structure, because this pointer is actually pointing there without the knowledge of the OS. So whenever the OS tries to change it, as I said, you make it read only. So you trap here and the kernel actually modifies it for you. Okay? Yes, question.
The page tables are generally going to be huge, right? Even in the virtual machine. So is there a facility where you can cache the page tables?
Cache the page table. So page tables are large. Cache for what? Performance reasons?
No, I mean something like a TLB.
You still use all of the hardware caches. That's not, I think, is not going to change because you're running a hypervisor.
What about in the virtual machine?
So the virtual machine is basically an application as far as you're concerned, right? So all of the page tables are going to be here, and the TLB is going to cache some of these entries for you. Okay, so when you do a lookup, you'll first look up in the TLB. If there's a miss, then you'll actually look up a memory location. All that is not changed. Okay? So the old model was, what was running in privileged mode was the OS. What we're running in user space is the application. Okay? In the new model, this is your new OS. These are the applications. It just so happens that this application is an OS by itself. That's the only thing that has changed. So it's like running an OS kernel in user space. That's the only thing that has changed. Okay, so all of the optimizations are the same. It's in fact, as far as the hardware is concerned, it doesn't know. You have a question there.
In direct mapping, actually, is it not possible that the real memory address would be greater than n from 0 to n? Actually, it knows the address from 0 to n. If you do direct mapping of physical to graphic, may just overshoot
n. No, I didn't follow what you're asking. Let me explain. So this is, let's say, physical RAM. Okay? Let's say 1 gig of RAM on your machine. When you create a virtual machine, you have to configure it with certain amount of memory. So you create a virtual machine and you say, I want to give it 512 MB. Okay? So the VM is going to request a chunk of this memory and then start managing it. Okay? In this case, let's assume it's a type 1 hypervisor. You say create a VM with 512 MB. It's going to, let's say, just take the memory, partition it into two, and this is what is going to be allocated to that VM. You could create another VM, say I need another 256. It'll take the free RAM and then it'll just give this to. So here is VM1. This is where VM2 is running. And then this is free space. Okay, now so as far as the OS within VM2, it will think this is memory address 0 and this is memory address n, because it thinks this is the actual amount of memory on the physical machine or in the virtual machine. And the OS that's running here thinks this virtual is address 0 and that's address n prime. Okay, but in reality, this is not 0 to n, it's something else. So that's the mapping that the hypervisor does for you.
So in direct mapping, so VM2 is actually n of the real hardware. What's
the question in direct mapping?
Have the same address, it will not be 0 on the time.
So this OS that is running in here, it's going to just assume it has 0 through n, n pages, right? Address 0 through n. It is going to access, let's say, page I. You look up the actual address of page I is stored in the shadow page table. It is going to point to some location here. Okay, that's what is happening. Any other question? Yes. How does something like memory mapped I/O? It is no different, because the only thing that is changing is transparently your address is changing. Okay. In memory mapped I/O, you just say map some file into some memory region. Okay. And you can basically, within a address space, you'll just specify memory region and map a file there. Okay. So this is basically, this OS thinks that this is location, let's say I through J. The only thing that's different is the real locations are maintained here. So it's completely, all of the stuff is completely transparent to the applications. Any other questions here? Is this clear, or is there any confusion still? What's happening? Yeah. Now, in the para-virtualized mode, you don't have to do this hack where you make the page table read-only, and when the OS tries to change it, you take a trap and you go into the kernel. You actually use hypercalls to inform the hypervisor. Okay. Since this is a modified kernel, whenever you want to do any page table operation, you don't try to do it yourself. You just make a hypercall saying, do the following. It changes the page table or allocate a new page table that goes into the hypervisor, and the hypervisor does it. So a cleaner implementation, not a hack, but that requires you to change the kernel. Okay, that's always the downside in para-virtualization. Is this clear? Okay. So the next is I/O virtualization. Yeah, so we talked about how to virtualize the CPU, meaning the sensitive instruction, how to virtualize memory. Now the last thing to do is virtualize I/O, and then you have virtualized all of the important hardware on your machine. Okay. So the basic idea is create virtual abstractions and multiplex them. Okay, so the simplest thing to think about is, how do you virtualize the network interface? Okay, so you have one physical network interface. It could be your wireless card or your Ethernet card. Okay. There are multiple VMs. All of them have to do network I/O. So somehow you have to multiplex this one physical card across multiple VMs. Okay, so again, going back to the picture, you have, let's say, your network Ethernet card. So this is physical Ethernet. This is the hypervisor. Okay, this is VM1, this is VM2. So what you do is you create virtual interfaces on this machine, and you multiplex them onto physical interface. So you create a logical card, let's say a logical Ethernet card, and you tell this interface that you have this card, logical card. So it tries to then basically send or receive packets on this card. Okay? And this one gets a different logical card, okay? Logical interface in this case, not really a card, but it's a logical interface, and this is basically multiplexed onto this physical interface. Okay? Whenever you try to send here, this basically triggers a request to the hypervisor, and the hypervisor just takes that and sends it here. And whenever something comes back, you basically queue it up here. Okay? So there's a logical driver here that is trying to manage this logical card, which is then multiplexed onto this physical card. This is how you are going to basically create multiple network interfaces and map them onto the same physical interface. Now, each of the logical interfaces to the operating system looks like a real interface, meaning it will have its own IP address and so on. Okay, so then once you give it its own IP address, this just looks, from the rest of the internet, this just looks like a machine that is just sitting on the network, assuming it has a real IP address. Okay. If you give it a NATed address, then you can't access it from the outside. But if it gets a real physical IP address, then you can just access this machine or that machine from the outside, as if it's a real machine on the network. Okay? So different VMs will have their distinct IP address, whether they're NATed addresses or real addresses is an orthogonal issue. Yes, question here.
If you have an incoming packet, is a packet sent to all the VMs?
How to demultiplex? That's basically what you're asking. So demultiplexing is very similar to so if it's a physical, so there are two ways to answer this question, right? If this is a real IP address, the packet is going to arrive at that destination address. So you know how to demultiplex it. Is that clear? So let's suppose this has IP address 192, not 192, let me just take 201.116.1.1, and this is, let's say, 1.2. So if the packet comes with this address, you just basically direct it here. When it comes with that address, you direct it. Now, if it is a NAT address, then what you are exposing to the outside world is your address, not these addresses. So you do essentially what a NAT router does, which is it will keep some state of how this maps to this. And so it will expose that, and when a packet comes in, you will demultiplex, just as you demultiplex in a NAT scenario. Okay, just as your router and a home cable network has to do the same thing. When a packet comes in, it has to decide which of your machines on your NAT network send that packet. The same thing is going to happen here.
So the virtual Ethernet cards, they have the same MAC address as the actual Ethernet?
How? No. They will also have their own MAC addresses. They will not have a physical address.
Because if the packet is not TCP IP or something below that, then...
Yes. So they will have their own MAC addresses as well. Because they have to, because otherwise this machine is not going to be able to talk to this device unmodified. Okay? This has to look like a real card to the rest of the machine. So it will have its own MAC address, it will have its own IP address and so on. It's just that it's not a real device. Okay, it's just a logical address that you're given to. Yes, question.
So how does the NIC
means
to know that it is running multiple IPs?
Does the NIC need to know? The NIC, the interface, the hardware doesn't do anything. Right? So there is a driver here that does know that something is multiplexed. Okay, so this driver, the actual device driver, which is running in the hypervisor, okay, needs to know that there are multiple logical interfaces that are running on this physical interface. So it can multiplex and demultiplex packets. Okay, otherwise, it won't be possible. Right, so this driver will know that there is a mapping that you established. If an ARP request comes, it depends on what you are looking for, right? So if you are actually specifying the IP address of this Ethernet card,
say one of the VMs.
Right. So if it's one of the VMs, it is basically just going to see this ARP. So at this level, all this is doing is packet forwarding. So there's a packet that's coming. It happens to be ARP, okay, but we don't care at this point. It is basically going to come with a broadcast address, right? If you do an ARP, it's a broadcast. So it's a broadcast packet. It just blindly forwards it to all of them. And then it's handled at this level. Okay, so if you have your Ethernet MAC address in there, you are going to respond. That's how it would work. Any other questions here? Okay, so if you have a type, so there are some variants of this picture that I just drew here. So the other variant is you are a type 2 hypervisor. This is actually assuming type 1. So in type 2, you have host OS here. Your type 2 hypervisor here, and then the guest runs inside the host. Okay. So in this case, the device driver is the driver, device driver at the host level. There's nothing special to be done. There's already a physical interface and there's a device driver which all other applications are using. Okay. So this hypervisor is just going to forward packets to the normal device. So if this is the case where you are running Windows or Mac or Linux on your desktop, so there's already a driver associated with the device, and this hypervisor is just merely using this device as if it's an application. Okay, no different. Okay. The only place where you have to do something is type 1, which is what I discussed here. Then the hypervisor also has to have device support. In this case, there is no device support needed because the host OS has taken care of it for you. Okay. But in this case, the hypervisor is performing the role of a kernel, so it has to have device driver support for all of the hardware devices on that machine. Okay, otherwise, it won't work. Is this clear? Any questions here? This is the last slide on virtualization, and then we are going to move to another topic.
Did you say also the special VM?
Yes. So either you have to use this device driver, okay? But if you don't want to implement all of the device drivers in the world, you can get around this by creating a special VM. Okay? And this is essentially what Zen does. Let me draw that picture here. Okay, so suppose you didn't want to implement all of the device drivers. Otherwise, whenever you write a hypervisor, you have to support a large number of devices. What could you do? Any thoughts? So if you don't want to use, write your own device driver, the only thing you do is use someone else's device driver. Okay? Now, you know that there are already operating systems that have implemented these drivers. Right? Windows and Linux have wide driver support. So why not just create a special VM here? Okay? And just run some commodity OS. Let's say you'll run Linux in here. Okay? And Linux comes with a host of device drivers. Okay? Now what you do is, rather than implementing your own driver, you configure Linux with the right driver. So whenever packets come in, you basically just forward it here and have this driver manage that device for you. Is this clear? So all you're doing is you're hosting the driver. Rather than hosting the driver here, you're hosting the driver there. Okay, this is just a special virtual machine. In Xen, it is called Domain Zero or VM Zero. Okay. This is basically a virtual machine that's running in privileged mode because this driver actually has access to physical hardware. All of the other drivers only have access to virtual hardware or virtual interfaces. But this driver is given direct access because you don't want to re-implement a driver. You are using Linux's driver. Okay. This allows you to now not go and start implementing hundreds of drivers and just leverage all of the drivers that are out there that some other OS already supports. So that's basically what that thing says. So you could have a type 1 hypervisor where you just host all the drivers in a special virtual machine and just basically forward everything through that driver. It increases overheads, as you can see, because you basically come down here and then you again go up and then that will send it through the device. But you are avoiding the hassle of implementing lots of drivers. Is that clear? Okay. Any other questions here? This is what Xen does, by the way, the Xen virtual machine, if you have played with it. Okay, so moving on, so we have finished virtualization. So now we are going to talk about some generic server design issues, which may be useful from several contexts, how to design a client-server system, and when you do your programming assignments, you'll probably have to think about some of these topics. Okay, so now we have to pop back a level up because we have come back to how do you design a distributed application. We talked about a host of issues from scheduling and virtualization. Now we are just asking the question of how do you put these together and come up with good designs. Okay? And here we are concerned mostly with server design. Okay? So the basic problem is to design an application that's partitioned into a client and the server. Client runs on one machine, server runs on some other machine. Okay. So server is providing a service, client has to then contact the server to make a request. Okay. So the first basic question you are going to have to ask when you design your client is how do you contact the server? How do you know where is it running on the network? Okay. Simplest thing is you hard code the IP address and the port number. Okay. Locating a server is sort of requires you to have two pieces of information. What machine is it running on, meaning what's the IP address of the machine is it running on? And the server is usually going to listen on an endpoint that's usually a socket. Okay, so it has that's a port number. The server listens on a port number, so you make a connection to that port, and then you get access to that application. Different applications or services may listen on different port numbers. So you need to know two things, the IP address and the port number. Okay? So IP address could be hard-coded, or you can use DNS lookups, and we'll come back to all of this later on. But so assuming you know the IP address somehow, how do you figure out what port number? Okay. Again, you could hard code that okay, by saying it's a well-known service, so it's going to listen on this port. Okay. There are many well-known services. Mail is a well-known service. Okay. If you run IMAP or SMTP, there is a port number that's already assigned to it. Okay. This is assigned to it by a standards body. So if you want to run your mail server, you just make it listen on that port. Okay, you could, of course, configure it to listen on some non-standard port. Then if you have a mail client, you have to do some extra configuration to say that's the port number to use. But if you do the default thing and make it listen on well-known ports, then all clients know that if you're listening on this port, that's the service. SSH is going to be port 22, for example, and IMAP is going to be port 495. So there are well-known ports. This is one thing you could do. Okay? But not all services are well-known. If you design your own app, you cannot ask a standards body to give it a well-known port number. Okay, there aren't enough ports to hand to everyone. Okay, so there are a whole bunch of ports that can be dynamically reused depending on circumstances. Okay, so you have to now pick a port from that ring and then assign it to your service. But then the question is, how does the client know where you are listening? Okay, and if you haven't hard-coded there has to be some way of it doing a lookup and figuring this out. Okay. So the two scenarios here are to use a directory service, have one level of indirection. Okay. So you run a service of your own application, you register it with a directory service that's maybe running on that machine saying, I'm application foo, okay, and I'm going to listen on this port. Okay, and you start listening. So now if some client wants to contact you, it has to first contact the directory service and say, is foo running on your machine? If so, what port is it running on? Okay. And since that application has registered itself, this information is already available in the directory service. The directory service is just a table, okay? Applications and port numbers. So it's going to just do a table lookup and say, yes, foo is registered with me, it's listening on this port. Okay? So it will return a port number to you. So client gets the port number and then the client can contact the service. Okay? That's how typically you would go and design this in a flexible way. Okay, then you can easily change the service the next time you start by just registering yourself on another socket number or rather another port number, and you register that with the directory service and everything is going to work just as fine. No changes have to happen at the client end because the client is always going to do a lookup first. Okay, is this clear? Okay. So the other way to do this is in Unix you have something called inetd. This is a daemon that is listening on a well-known port. And in this case, what happens is you register the application, not a port number, with inetd, saying, I am such and such application, whenever someone makes a request, start me. That's what you register. So in this case, the client is not going to say, where is this service listening? You just say, I want to contact this service. Okay, I want to contact SSH, as an example. Okay, or the SSHD. So this inetd is then going to dynamically start the service up if it's not already running. And then once it starts up, it will just return a port number back to the client saying, I just started it up, it's listening on this port, just contact this service. Okay? So inetd allows you to dynamically store. In this case, if there are no requests, there isn't a wasteful process that just sitting there waiting for requests. Okay? This process itself is started on demand and it's attached to an endpoint or a socket, and this socket is returned to the application. Yes, question here.
I thought inetd listened on a bunch of well-known ports on behalf of a bunch of applications.
Yes. So inetd, so you are asking a good question. So you could ask the question, how do you contact inetd itself in the first place? Okay, because you have to know how to contact this process and have it start up. So inetd, or for that matter, the directory service, has to listen on a well-known port. In the previous example I talked about, I said you contact the directory service and it will tell you the port number. For that, you need to know what port number the directory service itself is running on. Otherwise, you cannot contact it. Same thing is true here. Okay, if you contact inetd and say, start this service for me, you need to know how to contact it. So in both cases, these are listening on well-known ports. Okay, so you basically just send your request on this well-known port. And in this case, the directory service will do a lookup for you and return the results. In this case, inetd is going to receive your request, start that service up, and then return the results. Okay? Does that answer your question? Okay. So that's just the simple problem of how do you contact a service. Okay? Or when you write your server part of your application, how do you connect the client up to the server? Okay. The next design issue is, how do you write your server itself? Do you put state in the server or you keep your server stateless? Okay. Now, this is a very, at this level of discussion, is a very general discussion, but there are lots of important implications on the service you provide, what it does, and so on. Okay, so on the one hand, you could keep a stateful server, and in a stateful server, you keep state of every client that is connected to you. You know which clients are connected to you, what they are doing, and so on. Okay. Now, the best example of this is, let's say, a web server that's providing you with a shopping service, Amazon, for example. Okay? So you contact Amazon and you're doing something. In a stateful server, the Amazon actually keeps track of your session. What have you done in the past? What have you searched for? And so on. And it basically uses this to either customize your request or provide you with better service. Okay? So you keep track of what has happened. So for example, you put something in the shopping cart. Okay? This is state that the server has kept for you. For each session, there may be a shopping cart. So if you put something in the shopping cart, the server knows because it's keeping state. Okay, at some later point, you can go and say check out, and you, what is in the shopping cart shows up because the server knows this. Okay? That's a stateful server. Okay? A stateless server is one that does not maintain any state for the client. Okay? So there is no state maintained. You just do a request, it sends a response. Okay? There is no state that's maintained after the response is sent. Okay? So how would you do the shopping cart if you are a stateless server? If you are a e-commerce or less a website that is trying to sell something, what would you do? The server cannot keep state. So you cannot store state at the server, you have to store the state at the client. Okay, so in this case, the shopping cart state has to be sent to the client. Okay, what would really happen is you send a cookie to the client, you don't send a shopping cart. Okay, so cookie basically may even encode the state of the shopping cart, or in most cases it would be basically a long integer that's an index. Okay, so you wouldn't basically store the state, you can dynamically recreate the state based on this index. Okay, that you have. So in either case, the point I'm trying to make is there is no state kept there. The state has to be sent to the client. So next time the client contacts it, it has to present the state saying, this is what I had done in the past. Now I want to do this. I want to check out, for example. And you present the cookie which is used to regenerate the shopping cart, and then you are allowed to check. Just two different ways of designing the same application. Okay, very different design implications. Now what's good about the stateful server? Okay, there's less communication over it, the client has to do less. Okay? But in any stateful server, if the server crashes, state disappears. Okay, if the server that holds your shopping cart in memory has crashed, when it comes up, your shopping cart is going to be empty. Okay, from a user standpoint, this is not desirable. Okay, because you put something there and you go back and it disappears. So that's a problem with stateful server. Any server that keeps state cannot tolerate failures. Okay, unless the state is also checkpointed on disk, in which case if the server crashes, you can reload the state from disk. But checkpointing to disk itself will bring its own overheads. Okay, if you have to keep writing to disk, which is going to be very slow, every time you do this, that's problematic. The stateless server crashes have no implication because the server is not keeping any state. The service becomes unavailable for some time and then it comes back. But state is at the client, so you can go back with your cookie at some later time and present it. Server can regenerate that state for you. So more resilient to failures, but the problem is you have shifted the burden of doing this to the client. Okay, the client has to be more complex, and communication overheads are higher because you are sending the state back and forth every time. Okay. So that's the two design choices, stateless or stateful. Okay. Now there is something in between called soft state. Okay. And so this tries to extract the advantages of both of these. There is something appealing about both. This is more resilient to failure, that is more efficient. Now you want to try to do both. So what this does is it keeps state for a limited amount of time. It discards state after that time period expires. But the state is basically what's called soft state, not hard state. So even if the state disappears, it can be regenerated. Okay? So an example of this would be you create your application, the same shopping application, but when you put something in the shopping cart, you might send off a cookie. Okay? But you also keep track of the shopping cart on the server end, and then you tell the browser that until I ask you to send the cookie, don't bother, I know where you are, what you are doing. And if the server crashes and the state disappears, then the client can always cause the state to reappear by sending the cookie. But so long as the server is functioning fine, you just don't do anything. You don't ask for the cookie. You just keep it there on the disk, for example. Okay? So that's how you could do this. So in this case, correctness is not impacted, meaning that even if the server crashes, state is not lost because state is at both ends. Okay? It's the client and the server. The server is only keeping what's called soft state, which means it will keep it for some time and then it may discard it. Okay, so it is used to improve performance, but it doesn't impact correctness. So that in this case, so you're basically trying to extract the advantages of both of these approaches. Okay. So how to design your server, whether it's stateful, stateless, or you keep soft state, are all design choices. Okay, and you have to decide what's the right thing for the application you're designing. Now, the next issue is scalability, or how to create applications for very high volume requests. Okay, we briefly looked at this when I was talking about this multi-tier or multi-layered applications back in chapter 2. So now I'm going to talk about some more design issues when you look at this multi-tier application. Okay. So I already mentioned then that web applications tend to use this multi-tier architecture. Okay. And we looked at this example where you had these three tiers. Okay. There was an HTTP server. This is a web-based application. Okay. Then there is a J2EE server. And then you have a database server. Okay. Standard architecture for a web-based application. Okay. So this is a browser. Browser basically sends off a request, HTTP request. It comes to the HTTP server. HTTP server only does HTTP processing. It's not doing anything more. Okay, so it will just look at the request and send off the contents to the next stage. This is the second tier of the application. Okay, so this is where all of the interesting stuff happens. This is where the application is actually written. In this case, it's written in Java, or more specifically, enterprise version of Java. That's J2EE. Java 2 Enterprise Edition. So this is where you will write all of your application in Java. Okay, so it's going to look at the request saying, what is this request? Maybe you fired off a catalog search on your e-commerce application. Okay, you type search and you're looking for some books on this site, let's say it's Amazon. Okay. So then what is going to happen is this tier is going to, the actual information you're requesting for is going to be served in a database somewhere. Okay, it's in a separate tier. So here you have to then construct a SQL query and send that query off to the database. Okay? Database is then going to process that query, generate a list of results that match the query, return that response here. Okay? You will do some more processing, construct a template page, and then send it back to the HTTP server. The HTTP server is just going to return the response back to the browser, and you'll get the results of your search query. Okay? This is how typical web-based applications are written. Okay, now these are three components. If this is a small application, all three servers could run on the same machine. Okay. Now, if this is a large application, this is distributed across multiple machines. There are distinct processes. So the HTTP server runs on one machine, this server runs on another machine, and the DB server runs on a third machine. Okay. Now, if you want to scale this even further, okay, so suppose that you have very high volume of requests coming in. Okay, a single machine that runs HTTP server may not be able to handle this volume. So then what you have to do is you have to have replication at each tier. Okay, rather than one machine is running HTTP, you have a pool of machines. They all run HTTP. Okay, so this is tier 1 is replicated. Same thing may happen at the J2EE tier. Okay, so you will have multiple machines running. So think of Amazon. Right? It runs on hundreds if not thousands of servers. So this is not, the J2EE tier is not running on one server. It's going to run on hundreds of servers. So this is heavily replicated. Okay, so they are all running either the same application or different components of the application. Okay. So that is actually what is shown in this picture, where you have each tier is replicated. The database tier is replicated, and this J2EE tier is replicated. The web tier is also replicated. So now how do you go about how does the request flow through this? That is what I wanted to actually show there. Okay. Now, because this is replicated, and yet it has to be transparent from the browser. Okay. From the browser end, you cannot say, I will expose to you that I run 123 machines, and you have to pick which machine to contact. Okay. This doesn't work. So what you basically do is you still present the illusion as if the whole thing is running on one machine. Okay. From a browser standpoint, Amazon.com is one IP address. What is behind this IP address, the browser doesn't know. Okay? So there is this front end, which is called a dispatcher, which is going to present one IP address to the rest of the world. In this case, if it's Amazon, it will present one IP. So the browser is just sending a request here. Okay? Now, this is the first tier dispatcher. When a request arrives here, it is going to then pick one of these replicas and forward to it. Okay? Now, the dispatcher can use any algorithm to do this forward. It could use least loaded. Okay. Or it could use simple round robin, where the first request goes to the first replica, the second request goes to the second replica, and so on, and you do round robin, simplest forwarding strategy. Or you keep track on the load on each of these machines and say, here's a request, this is the least loaded machine, I'm going to send it to this replica. So this is the forwarding algorithm that is used by the dispatcher. Now if each tier is replicated, you have to have a dispatcher at each tier as well. So here, let's say the request arrived here. This HTTP server has to then forward the request to one of these replicas. Again, to simplify things, you basically create a load balancer or a dispatcher. This HTTP server merely contacts that dispatcher, and this dispatcher picks one of the J2E servers and sends it, and so on. And that's basically what is shown in this picture, where there's a dispatcher that's dispatching requests. Now, what is shown in the second picture is what is actually happening when you do all of this at the TCP level. I just said you forward requests and so on, but if you start thinking from a protocol stack standpoint, how is this going to work? So for that, let's ignore all the other replicas. Let's just take the first one for simplicity. So you have a browser. And you have your dispatcher. And then there are these HTTP. This is just tier 1 replicated. So your HTTP or Apache server. Now, the browser is just making an HTTP connection. And this is the machine it is contacting. This is an IP address. So it basically sets up a TCP connection to this machine. And then it sends the HTTP request on this connection. Now, as far as it is concerned, it thinks it's talking to an HTTP server. So it wants to get a response back with the browser. Doesn't change just because you changed the architecture here. So what is happening under the hoods? So when I said you forward the request, so when this TCP connection is established, this dispatcher may pick this replica. So if this dispatcher wasn't present and this was the only replica, you would have set up a direct TCP connection between this browser and that machine and send the HTTP request there. You want to make this system behave exactly like that without and keep all of this replication transparent to the application. In this case, the application is browser. This is also replication transparency. I've talked about this in the very first class. So what is done here is that the easiest thing to do is set up another TCP connection. So this is going to basically just set up a TCP connection. Whatever is coming down on this connection is merely copied onto that socket connection. So this is just doing relaying. Also called TCP splicing. So basically you have taken two of these TCP connections and just spliced them together. So there's basically a dotted arrow here. So everything that's going here just merely goes there, and everything that comes back this way. In this fashion, this is completely transparent to the browser. You don't know what is going on. This is one level of doing TCP forwarding. There are some other tricks you could play where you do actual forwarding of the TCP connection without knowledge of the browser. So you basically take the TCP SYN request and you could just send it there. So then all further requests are funneled there. Again, transparent to the browser, but we'll not go into all of that here. We will come back to this when we talk about the web in a later chapter. Which is the only thing I wanted to mention was the notion of replication to achieve scalability at each tier, and then some lower level details of how is this handled, because you want to keep this all of this replication transparent, otherwise the complexity goes up. Any questions here? Is this clear? So a quick case study, and then I'm going to talk about some other stuff in server design. So there are two or three here. So I think there's Planet Lab, and then we'll come back to some more case studies a little later. So Planet Lab is another, why did I put this up here? So this is basically experimental infrastructure. Planet Lab is just a set of machines that are distributed across many universities on the internet. And researchers use this machine to run their experiments. So if you're a networking researcher, you want to run experiments across the internet. The old way was you contact a friend, get a guest account on their machine, run one part of your application there, one part here, and then you do some experiments over a wide area. Planet Lab simplifies this. And what Planet Lab does is there are few machines that are hosted by each university. And in return, you can use machines that are hosted elsewhere, okay, to run your experiments. And then this is done using virtualization, because there may be multiple experiments all running at the same time on any one machine, and you want to isolate these experiments from one another. Okay, I'm running experiment, someone else from some other university is also running an experiment on the same machine. I don't care what they are doing, they don't care what I'm doing. So we have to isolate one of these experiments from one another. So this is done by virtualization. Okay? So each experiment gets a slice of the machine. A slice is just some fraction of the resource. So you may get 10% of the machine, a 10% slice. Okay, 10% of the CPU, 10% of the memory, maybe 10% of the bandwidth. Okay? And the, so some other person comes along, they request a slice, they get another fraction of the machine. Okay, each of this is run inside a virtual machine, so we get isolated from one another. Okay? Now, in the context of Planet Lab, what they're doing is OS level virtualization. They don't use VMware. They don't start a new VMware every time somebody asks for an experimental slice. What they do is they just create these containers that guarantee you some fraction of that server. Okay, in this case, they're using the Linux vServer or the Linux virtual server, which is OS level virtualization. Okay, that's the, what I had mentioned earlier. Okay. So you go and you ask for a slice, you get your own virtual server, and then you run whatever you want on that virtual server. Okay? The, what code you run is not known to Planet Lab, neither do they care. It is isolated or sandboxed within the virtual server. So if it misbehaves, so be it. It cannot take over the machine because it's isolated. Neither can it impact other experiments. You are guaranteed some fraction, and you will not get anything more than that fraction. Okay? So that's basically how Planet Lab runs. It's basically this distributed infrastructure. So there are hundreds of universities that participate in this. Okay, so I'm sure there are several thousand machines now. When it started up, there were about 50 universities. So there are three machines at UMass, for example. So we run three machines on this Planet Lab overlay. And you get some accounts on this, and you can use accounts on other machines. Okay. So that's basically one example of how virtualization has been used in this case to do networking research. Okay, so there are people are using this widely. Any questions here?
The data has to be migrated all the data gets migrated.
Ah, yes, question about data. So data has to be copied over, right? So when you get a virtual server, if you want to, let's say, run a streaming server, if you want to do some experiments on video streaming, you have to copy your video files over to that machine, and then your server will stream it from there to some other machine. Okay, so this does not run a distributed file system. All the data is local. Okay, so you have to do a lot of data copying. That is indeed true. That also limits how much you can do, because you can't copy tens of gigabytes of data back and forth. That's high overhead. Any other questions here? Okay. So the last thing here, and we'll probably not finish this topic today, is code and process migration. Okay, this is the last thing in the chapter 3, and then we'll be done. Okay. So if you remember the discussion on distributed scheduling, so I was talking about the Sprite scheduler, and I said that in the Sprite scheduler, you can basically suspend a process at any point in time, and then just move it to another machine and resume execution there. And I said you need this facility called process migration to do this, where a currently executing process is suspended, its entire state is moved to some other machine and resumed there. Okay. So now we are going to look at this issue in a little more detail as to how does this actually happen. Okay, what do you need at the operating system level in order to enable process migration? Okay, so we look at two forms of process migration. One is actually called code migration, and another one is traditional process migration. So whenever I say process migration, this is also referred to in the literature as strong mobility. Okay, and whenever I talk about code migration, this is referred to in the literature as weak mobility. The difference between the two is as follows. In process migration, you can take a process and that's executing at any arbitrary point, suspend it and move it elsewhere and resume execution. Okay? So in other words, whenever you migrate a process, the code associated with the process migrates, as well as the state associated with the process, which is the data that it has in memory, also migrates. Okay? In code migration, as the name suggests, only the code is moving. Okay? and the process doesn't move. In other words, in code migration, the code comes to a machine and then you start a new process to execute that code. Okay? Simplest example of code migration is Java applets, okay, which you probably know. So in Java applets, a browser just downloads some Java code from the server, okay, and it starts a new process that's executing that applet. This is called code migration because the code wasn't resident on your browser before. It was fetched on the fly from some remote server and you're just executing it on your machine. The code did move from one machine to another and it's executing elsewhere. Okay? So here, as I said, the shipment of server code to the client. So there are various forms of this. Okay? Simple HTML code with embedded JavaScript, okay, can also be thought of some form of code migration because some server is sending you some code. So if you do form filling, for example, okay, you fill some entry in a form, it can do local checks to see if that entry is correct. Right. So, for example, if you are filling the date, it may say it wants the year in YYYY, not just the last two digits. So, if you put something that's only two digits, it can pop up an error without sending this back to the server. So, server has just sent some JavaScript. So, it is looking at what you entered in this text box on the browser. It's doing some local checks. Okay. But this code was sent from the server, nevertheless. So, this is a valid form of code migration as far as we are concerned. Okay. So there are various flavors of this. You could send very small snippets of code in HTML pages, or you could send entire applets, which are full-fledged programs, as far as we are concerned, to the server, or some part of the client application. Okay, so in this case, for example, rather than, so this is a good example of how you can design distributed databases. So in a regular database, you send a SQL query to the server. Okay? SQL query is really a program that the database is executing. Okay, so this is also one form of code migration where you construct a query, which is effectively a program that the server is executing by executing that query. Okay, web search is another example. You type up some keywords, but that at the server end, that actually generates a program which is a query and executes it. Okay, now why is this important? So we already talked about one scenario where process migration is useful. Okay, that was the case where you're trying to use idle cycles in a network of workstations. Okay. There are many other reasons why you might want to just do code migration, not process migration. So dynamic configuration of your distributed system is one example. Okay. You don't have to have all of the code installed on this machine. You can fetch what is needed on the fly and only run that piece. So many systems now distribute device drivers in this fashion. Okay, if you use any modern flavor of Windows, for example, you plug in a new device, let's say plug in a new printer. Okay, if it will look whether the driver is already installed. If not, it will pop up a box saying, do you want me to look for a driver for you? Okay, it can actually go to some remote repository and download the driver on the fly. Okay, this is a form of code migration where the driver code is resident somewhere else. It's just brought on the fly. So you don't have to have drivers for 300 printers pre-installed on your machine. Okay? Whenever you plug in that device, the driver is fetched on the fly and machine is configured and ready to go. Okay? So this makes configuration of machines much simpler and improves flexibility. Okay? So that's exactly what is actually shown in this picture, where you can just generalize this from a driver to any software. Okay, so you're basically downloading an application on demand whenever you need it. So application is in some repository. The first time the client accesses it, you go and fetch the code and you run it. Okay? Microsoft Office also has this feature. If you've played with it, you know, when you do the standard install of Office, it will have several components it won't install. But it will actually have menu bar boxes for them. And the first time you access it, it will ask you to put a CD into your machine. You know, it is getting the device of your code from a CD, could have fetched it from a repository as well. Okay. So these are just various examples where you can do download on demand and run the code. Okay. That's the reason why code migration is useful. Okay. And now we'll talk about how to go about doing some of these things. Okay. So I don't have a lot of details on process migration. Okay. So the only thing I would mention is when you migrate a process, you take everything that's in the memory address space of the process and move it. Okay? And all the stuff that you have involves the code segment, the resource segment, and basically the stack segment. Okay? So just to draw a picture here. So you take a process that's executing in memory, the memory layout of the process would have some pages that contain the code. This is the code that the process is executing. Okay. You have a stack, this is the program stack, and there if this is multi-threaded, there will be many stacks, one per thread. You would have a heap, so this is the part of the memory address space that you use to do mallocs and so on, dynamically allocated memory. And then there may be some other resource segments, okay, that access resource, and let's not worry about them. Okay. So if you migrate this process, everything that's in memory here has to move somewhere else. Okay, and you resume execution somewhere else.
You mean the resource segment includes pin table, the RSVs, or files?
Yes, so this could be files or shared memory or semaphores or things like that. Okay. So the basic point is, whenever you migrate a process, you migrate the whole, all of its memory state, and you resume execution elsewhere. Okay, so and this, so you basically have to start this memory copying where you just take all of these pages one at a time, send it over a network somewhere else. Okay, so there's another process machine somewhere else, and these pages are basically going over a network, and they appear here. And when all of the pages are migrated, you have an exact snapshot of what is here on this machine. Yeah. And then you can resume execution here. So this is basically low-level details of what process migration entails. Okay. Now, the big problem with process migration is if you are accessing any resources, okay, migrating that is a lot more challenging than just migrating code. I mean, this is easy. You can just take all of this memory and just copy it. Okay, you're done. But what if there was a socket connection on this machine? When you have a socket connection, this is state associated with the application, but the socket connection is maintained in the kernel space. Okay? This state is not going to move when the application moves. Or if you have open files, okay, so you have a local file system here, a disk and a local file system. This process is accessing a file here. Okay? It has an open file descriptor. You move this here, the file descriptor will move, but the file hasn't moved. So when you try to access that file here, you are going to get an error because it will try to access the local disk and it will basically that will just result in an error. So the big problem with process migration is what happens to resources that a process is using at any given point in time. And if you deal with that problem, then the rest of it is actually easy. It's fairly mechanical. And that's what we are going to talk about on the next few slides. Okay. Now, in weak mobility, this is not a big issue because only the code is moving. In other words, just download some code, you start a new process. Okay. So the notion of resources doesn't really come into the picture because there was no process to begin with that you're migrating. Only fetch some code over a network and started it. So the program is essentially starting from initial state. Okay. Now, there's the issue of who initiated this migration, whether the senders initiated it or the receiver initiated. Okay, sender initiated, the code is with the sender and you send it off somewhere else to run. Okay. Client sending a query to a database server is an example of sender initiated migration. The query was with the sender, you sent it off. Okay. In the receiver initiated, someone is asking for the code. Okay. Java applets is an example. The browser doesn't have the code. The browser is the receiver and it asks some server to send it the code. And it brings it over the network and it runs it. Okay. So there is that issue. And then there is the issue, final dimension here is who executes the migrated entity. Okay. And so in code migration, you have two choices. You execute this in a separate process. Okay. You fetch some code, you execute it within the browser, or do you start a different process? These are the two choices. Okay. So you could run in browser space, or you could, for that matter, the process that brought it, or you could start a new process. Okay. In process migration, there is this notion of remote cloning, which is similar to the notion of the fork system call. Okay. Does people know what fork does?
Right.
So whenever you do a fork, a process does a fork. This is a system call, and the fork causes the kernel to create an exact snapshot of this process. Okay, so now there are two copies. There's a parent and a child. They're identical in all respects. The memory contents are identical. Okay, so in other words, fork basically allows you to replicate the memory content and just create a second copy. Okay, and then the parent and child from this point can do different things. Now, our process migration is also doing the same thing, except that the copy is on a different machine, not on the same machine. So you can think of process migration at one level as a remote cloning or a remote fork. So you're doing a fork, but saying make the copy on this machine, not on the local machine. And then you just transfer the contents and you execute also. Now the only thing in process migration is the parent terminates after the thing is done. In normal fork, the parent and child can continue independently. The parent doesn't have to die. Process migration, you will just transfer the state and the parent will stop. The child will continue execution. So this basically picture shows all of these possibilities of mobility where you have process migration which is strong mobility or weak. In each case you could have the sender who initiated it or the receiver, and then within this you basically either clone the process to do a remote fork or you do the migration which is this. Essentially they achieve the same thing, and in the weak mobility you have code is brought over, you start a new process or you execute it within the context of the process that brought the code over. Okay. So depending on which possibility you pick, you have these 8 choices or 8 dimensions of process or code migration. Okay, so now let's come to the most interesting part. Actually we are run out of time, but the part where we'll discuss what happens to resources. Okay. So here I'll just introduce this and stop here. We'll continue next time. In some sense, if you want the application or the process to continue execution even after it's moved, you have to worry about how can it continue to access the old resource somehow. Okay? Otherwise, it's going to get an error. Okay? So the choices that you have are the resource moves with the process, or the process gets remote access to the resource. Okay? This is how you're going to let the process continue. Okay, so if the resource is lightweight, let's say it's a small file, it's possibly you can just move the file with the process. So when on the new machine the process is there and a copy of the file has appeared, and it can continue to execute it. But if it's something that's expensive to move or you cannot move it, if it's a hardware device, for example, you can't move it. So in this case you have to give it remote access, meaning the process will move, but when it tries to access that resource, you will now basically direct that request to this remote device, not to a local device. Okay? So these are the choices, and in the next class we will talk about under what scenarios are you going to pick which choice. Okay, so let's stop here. We'll continue next time. Just one thing. I'm going to put up a homework, a real homework, not the first one was not going to count. We are towards the end of chapter 3, so we have gone through almost 3 chapters by now. Just to force you to read, I'm going to put up a short homework that will require you to review all of this material. Okay, so it's going to be on the website sometime in the next 2 hours. It's due a week from today. Okay, actually not a week from today, a week from Thursday. Next Tuesday is virtual Monday, so we don't have a class, but a week from Thursday is when it will be due. Okay, so let's stop here. We can continue.